Real life.
Superpowers.
I remember many nights where I would take the bus from like New York to Boston and not wanting to and get in at like, say, 3 a.m. I wouldn't want to spend the money on the hotel room. So you just grab your bag, find a bench in the central bus station and spend the rest of the night there and then go to your meeting. Wash up in the bathroom, go to your meeting at 9 o'clock.
Hey, today we're joined by Aaron Horowitz, CEO of the Jerusalem-based startup Fullpath. Aaron has made a real impact on both social and tech landscapes. From fighting anti-Semitism as a student at Columbia University, to founding a social venture accelerator for marginalized communities, and now leading a fast-growing company in the automotive market, Aaron's story is about purpose, resilience, and giving back. In this episode, we'll hear how Aaron's personal experiences have influenced his approach to entrepreneurship, leadership, and community. Let's dive in.
Real life.
Superpowers. Superpowers.
Welcome to Real Life Superpowers, Aaron.
Hey, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
So what are you up to these days?
I'm really focused on my company, the company I lead, Fullpath. I think like every few years, there's like a level up that has to happen. And so it takes just intense focus. That could be like, it could be management. You feel like, okay, we have to change some things in how we structure stuff, manage stuff. Because of just the size, it could be because there's a crisis. Sometimes it's all at once, which seems to be pretty common, in the way things have been the past few, the past 5 years. So I'm just very intensely focused on work.
It's really interesting that you're saying that there's always something and how you leverage it. Do you want to maybe expand a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think like our reality here in running a company. I mean, when you look at COVID and you look at the war, and you also look at a company that's scaling quickly, which Fullpath, our company, has been scaling quickly. I mean, we've grown from probably during that period, 30, 40 people all the way to over, 200 to 250 to 250 people almost. So, there's been a lot of like scaling growth which on its own is a challenge. You have to think about, does the management, do the processes that you have in place scale up? Often they don't, right? It could be like, HR looks very different at 250 than it does at 40 or in 50, in terms of how you have to manage that. And then you add to that the complexity, for example, during the war of just a revolving door. I mean, we've had such a huge percentage of our company in and out on Miluim and spouses in and out on Miluim on reserve duty. So that's been like a very interesting challenge, and we've had to be very flexible and supportive, but also understand how to have a lot of redundancy and no single points of failure in the company, so that we don't miss a beat. So there's just those types of challenges, from my view, is like thinking about how we solve for those have definitely taken a lot of my energy, and at the same time, I think we always want to be pushing the envelope, doing new things, building new products. I mean, our company works in a vertical in the auto industry and transportation. So there's a lot that can be done there. And we never want to miss a beat just because there's, there's these other externals or internal scaling challenges. So that's like, I feel like if you ask what I spend my time on, it's like, how do we do both and versus either or?
Aaron, okay. So give me the different stages. Okay. So first of all, what's the toughest? Is it between like 0 to 20 employees, 20 to 50, 50 to 200, 200 plus, which one is the hardest?
Well, I think most entrepreneurs, I don't know about most. Let me speak to myself. I think naturally for myself, I enjoy the small, the 0 to 1, as they call it, because it's almost like everything's at the speed of thought and the speed of light. You're just in a mind meld with your team and everything's very organic, right? If someone joins the team, it's for a very organic reason. It's not through planning. It's just, oh yeah, we've got to get this done. Let's find someone we know who's awesome at it and get them in the room. You're all sitting in the same room and there's that energy that's created. So I think like on a DNA level, there's just nothing like that. That said, it's very, very challenging because, in our case, I mean, the stories I can tell you of that period were pretty intense. I mean, they included you know, nights sleeping on benches in central bus stations across the United States. They included running out of money, you know, and trying to figure out how we're going to pay our bills personally and professionally for months at a time. I mean, insane things, you know, working out of dirty apartments because we couldn't find an office, going to the public library at Hebrew University and just working there until they kicked us out eventually, realized we were a company and weren't students studying for finals. You know, those types of things that we did. But, you know, those are all good stories in retrospect and fun. So I love that stage. But I think, like, each stage brings its own exciting challenges. And when you get the right people for each stage, and, you know, as you scale, you can kind of add to the team. And I think at all state times, you're working with a mix of people who kind of grow and then a mix of people you bring in to help. It can be great and exciting.
And what stage? Okay, so usually they said there's a 3-year period where they say companies don't know if they're going to survive or not. Okay, what was the moment when you said, okay, this child knows how to walk and it's going to be a child? It may be this kind of child, that kind of, you know, but when do you know that the company is just, you know, it's here to stay?
So I would say I only knew that looking backwards. I never really, I don't know if there was a moment where I woke up and said, oh, wow, I remember when it was really difficult for us to get 20 paying customers.
Uh-huh.
And I was just thinking to myself, like, how am I going to get 20 paying customers? Then, you know, we had 20, but 20 doesn't really pay your bills. And you get to 50, you're like, okay, I've got 50 somehow. No idea how I got here. It was just literally phone calls and late nights and networking and whatnot. There comes a point where I think when I looked back and I saw we had, again, we're in a B2B. We sell to primarily car dealerships and a little bit to the car makers, automakers, you know, the folks who make the cars. When I looked back and I saw we had like 350 clients, I was like, oh, this is going to be something. Like, this is happening. And then you just started to feel a change in how the go-to-market worked, where it wasn't all through, it wasn't this like Sisyphean feeling of, you know, push that rock up the hill and then it rolling back down and rock up the hill, rolling back down. It started to feel like, oh, wait, yes, I'm still pushing rocks, but there's also people who are pulling them up and it's getting easier and easier. So I think it was around for us, I would call it not so much on the revenue. It was more around 350 customers. I felt like we're going to be something.
But Aaron, I'm really curious now because you were describing some extreme situations. And I'm wondering, what is the motivation? I want to say the drive, but, you know, with the play of words, it sounds always like a joke in your industry. But really,
yes, indeed.
What drove you to persist? Was there some form of a dream here about, of reaching something? Because you just said, you know, at 350, you realized that that this is serious. I mean, I'm sure you thought it was serious, but you realized this is happening. So that means that it wasn't a number that you had in mind before. And you're sitting there sleeping on a bench and you can't pay the bills at home. Is it ego? What makes you stick? Or is it pot committed? What is it?
Well, yeah. So, you know, the bench thing sounds very extreme. It was that we at various points, we didn't have, we either ran out of money or was pre-investment and, you know, spending money on a hotel room, which for, you know, you hear, you read the news about startups. You don't think, oh, they think about how much it costs to have a hotel room. But, you know, at the time, $200 and a $200 hotel room. So I remember many nights where I would take the bus from like New York to Boston and not wanting to and get in at like, say, 3 a.m. I wouldn't want to spend the money on the hotel room. So you just grab your bag, find a bench in the central bus station and spend the rest of the night there and then go to your meeting at, you know, wash up in the bathroom, go to your meeting at 9 o'clock.
Wow.
You know, that was the type of thing that we would do in the early days because we were just very locked in on success and very conscious of how much cash we had. I say that again, as you point out, like there is always a drive element, no pun intended, but I think for me, I mean, you know, I mean, as you can hear by my accent, I'm an Israeli entrepreneur, but I was not born in Israel. I was born in the Midwest in Cleveland, Ohio. And I grew up in a family that was very activist oriented, or just in general, like very much involved in things bigger than just sort of like the daily, you know, your daily life and comfort of daily life. My father was a teacher, my mother and a coach, my mother like a social worker. And in general, they were like, you know, active in the struggle for Soviet Jewry stuff, Jewish community stuff. I mean, I grew up in like a very activist environment and sort of a very much an awareness of like it matters what you do for the broader, for the community, for a broader world. And I always wanted to move to Israel from pretty much as early as I can remember. And when I came to Israel, finally, again, through various things, right before the startup, I'd really got involved in like social entrepreneurship, which is really my passion, which is like social impact stuff. So my friend and I, Ariel Beery, had founded a nonprofit called Present Tense, and we were doing like social impact incubation, kind of like a Y Combinator or seed camp for social entrepreneurs. And this didn't exist at the time in any meaningful like seed way. And we were launching these like socially minded startups, for profits, not for profits. And at some point like that had gotten pretty big. And I was like, okay, I'm going to, you know, it was time to pass the reins. And I just had this feeling like I wanted to build something out of Jerusalem, which is where I live, that would create jobs, be exciting. There weren't a lot of startups in Jerusalem. I just felt like I can do it. And it would be really good for the city. It would be good. It would be exciting for me. I could find, you know, friends to do it with. And we just kind of like, you know, I connected with my co-founders, Eliav and Yishai, and we're like, we're going to build this thing. And we at no point sat down and said, hey, here's our red lines. Here's when we stop. Here's how hard. We didn't even know we were going to get money to build it. We were just like, we're just going to do this. So at no point did it ever occur to me that this was not the way. I didn't have any model of, oh, this is how a startup is done. I was just like, we're going to do this.
Is that a good thing? Is it maybe ignorance is a bliss here?
I think ignorance was, I wouldn't call it bliss, but ignorance was an effective tool to get us to keep working. So at some point we actually raised some money from angels. And at the minute I took in money, I was like, I have to make this work. I mean, I took in other people's money. This has to become a success. So I had a feeling of obligation towards like the mission. We really wanted this to work for Jerusalem and for the city. And for, you know, eventually we expanded to Tel Aviv and to America. But, and then also just like these people who put money in, I have to make this work. So I don't know. I never thought about it differently. We were always going to make it work in my mind. That was kind of the way I always approached it, which again, I don't know if that's like a classic Israeli startup entrepreneurial approach, but that was how I thought about it.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, CalkalistEch.com, to stay up to date on all high-impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
Okay, you're in Israel, and you were talking about like the industry of, you know, automotives, okay? Which Israel is not like an automotive place to do, like... You're saying this has to work. We'll do it. Ignorance is bliss. But I'm sure.
What was the car called here? What was the name of the car
we said?
The Susita, right?
Yeah, that was the last. It was a car that it was eaten by camels because it was
exactly
heroes that were half food. But
hey, eco car that would work today. Good.
It would work today. It would work. It was you know, for its time. But you know, the industry here, it's not like except for like maybe Shai Agassi, there wasn't any kind of traction. Okay, like. You know, you're saying ignorance, like you walk around and you say, why do you think that this in Jerusalem would probably work? Okay. There has to be like someone had to be in the team say, listen, I have, you know, it's like there's being adventurous as there's being, you know, confident without base.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, we did not begin the company looking at the auto industry. We were very interested in making tools for small, medium businesses. That was something I was passionate about coming out of Present Tense, the nonprofit, because it was all we were setting up these SMBs. And my partner Yishai had been volunteering for a nonprofit that was like supporting the SMB ecosystem. Eliav also, you know, had a similar background. And we just wanted to do tech for SMBs because we felt like HubSpot and Marketo, all that stuff was just too complicated or not automated enough and not using machine learning. It wasn't advanced. And, right. And Yishai had a good background in NLP and natural language processing and machine learning. And Eliav was doing a lot of really cool cutting edge stuff on mobile. And so we were like, you know, we're going to build some tools for SMBs that are automated, that are really smart, that use like, we didn't call it AI at the time, that uses machine learning. And we're going to build that stuff. And frankly, like we built some great stuff. A few customers signed up. We got it out there. We had some great customers. The tech was great, but we were not managing to get traction. And when you're selling to every SMB in the world, that's not a good plan. like if an entrepreneur is like, hey, we're going to sell to every SMB in the world. I mean, maybe if you have a really good angle or you're in, you get lucky or you could be, but it's a very difficult lift. And actually, one of the local Jerusalem sort of high-tech leader folks who actually, you know, expanded to Tel Aviv like us, Ellie Wertman from Pico Ventures, he'd been in the auto industry for a long time as an investor. And he was telling us, hey, you have to look at auto. Car dealers are a great vertical for this type of tech. And he was not an investor at the time. He was just sort of giving friendly advice. And then at some point we were like, you know what? Okay, we don't want to do auto for various reasons, prejudices that we didn't know much about the industry. And at some point I was like, you know what? We're kind of stuck. We see some good traction with the tech. It's working well on like construction dealers. Maybe auto could work. And I like flew to Ohio, got people to let me like intern at car dealerships. And we like eventually realized, oh, this is going to be an amazing industry for us. And I think, Ronen, in answer to your question, it's not about the auto. It's about software. Meaning software is, you know, to quote Andreessen, it's eating the world. Everything is software. Vehicles today, by the way, are called like software-defined vehicles. It's all just software. And Israel actually has done a lot of auto software. Obviously, Mobileye here in Jerusalem and other companies around Israel. But just everything is software. So we were able to come into these dealerships that were using software, which was really developed 10, 15 years ago and hadn't really evolved, and say, hey, we have software that has evolved and we figured out how to hook into your flow and your systems. We learned the business quickly and we applied software to it.
And there weren't actually any large competitors because you stepped into an ocean that you didn't really know. You didn't know much about the industry at all. You were even reluctant to enter it because you were sort of deterred, it seems. And then you jumped in. But I assume that it wasn't like a blue ocean here, right?
No, it's definitely not a blue ocean. What I'd say we do, and again, like I think this is a good practice if you're someone like us who is an immigrant into a industry, is to just go and spend time with the customers. And by the way, I think Israeli companies are great at this, like the concept of design partnership, where you find a customer in the space and you just build it in a way that doesn't scale with that customer and you understand it and then you scale, then you figure out how to scale it. Israeli companies, I think that's actually an under-referenced power of Israeli companies.
But having said that, it's also probably like sometimes when you were like what I see is also on one hand, it's great, but on the other hand, sometimes that one client tells you to put in features and widgets, okay, and takes you on a route where it's only relevant for him. And you know what I mean? Like, so, like, haven't you found that it's also dangerous because that same client is asking to customize for him and it may not be the scale? Do you know what I mean?
100%. That is a huge risk of the design partner approach. And we actually, like, tried to destigmatize that risk within the company. We accepted the fact that we were going to have some legacy stuff that we wouldn't scale up, and only over time would we work it out. And we thought about time in terms of years, meaning we were aware that for us to get what we needed from, you know, these first five customers, we might make some mistakes and build things that we were going to have to keep pushing along until we eventually could work it out and work them into something that is scalable. So I think like that is a approach that that has a lot of risks with it. But if you play the long term, you also kind of depressurize your team on that a bit. Now, again, there's a risk. And this is where like is either a CEO or a CTO or someone can kind of keep the line. What is that bright line between becoming a software development shop and actually, scaling a SaaS business? I mean, there is a bright line. It's totally obvious when you're inside where that line is. But you have to communicate around that because a lot of times your team is uncomfortable with that close relationship with a single customer. I found that, you know, and I think that has benefits, but sometimes you need that relationship, especially if you don't know anything about the industry. I mean, we did not know. And I remember walking into these dealerships and they would throw all this jargon at me. I mean, like the US auto industry is a powerhouse. And if you think about it, like, transportation is a core human need. Like you guys know the Maslow's pyramid of human need.
Yep.
Right. So at the bottom, there's shelter and warmth and food and power, right? All those are the biggest businesses in the world. Power is so big. It's a governmental business in many cases. Right. But like getting from place to place more securely you know, more and more comfort and more speedily has been a very important human thing since we like built roads and put, you know,
wait, where is it on the Masao? You say like
it's low. It's like
the third or second.
I don't remember if it's like, I think it's second, but we can check it up afterwards. Like okay. It's low, it's core. And I think that like, the whole human evolution of transportation is very interesting, going from like, you know, riding with saddles without saddles to saddles. But anyways, car dealers in a weird way are just the latest infrastructure providers of transportation. And, you know, some of these dealers that I meet, like I remember meeting this dealer in Washington, D.C., who told me like his great grandfather was a peddler who had immigrated to the U.S. His brother had a bicycle shop, his uncle. And he like worked at the shop. And one day there was a knock on the door and it was a guy named Henry Ford. And he said, hey, you guys have a nice bicycle shop. I'm going to be selling this thing called a car soon. He didn't call it a car, whatever, automobile. Can I use this half of your, can I take this half of your shop and you guys will fix the car. I'll teach you how to fix it. Sure enough, he became a Ford dealer, one of the first Ford dealers. And that was like happening all across the United States. And there was this weird moment where frankly, like some of these car dealerships were selling buggies and cars at the same time, you know, and on the road, there were horses and buggies, and there were vehicles, right? You see those old videos. So I think car dealers actually are just like, it's huge. We're talking like trillions of dollars of sales a year. There's a lot to do there. And it created a huge scaling opportunity for us, even though we had to go through Ronan that like, you know, some of that weirdness in the early days to learn the industry.
And were there times where you thought, you know, this is too much, we should stop?
I've often thought this is too much, but I've never thought we should stop. So, you know, usually my approach to too much is, okay, what do I do to get this back under control or structure it? Or, you know, and there have been definitely hard times. I mean, Corona was very hard. I mean, we entered COVID-19, or as they say in America, or Corona, as they say in Israel. We entered like Corona not in the best spot. I mean, we were growing great. We were working on another funding round. We were, you know, about to get a term sheet from, as every company will tell you, we were actually about to get a term sheet from a really well-known fund. And then like just everything stopped. And we, you know, our customers had to close their businesses. They're like, we don't know if we could pay our bills. I'm like, I don't know if we have enough money to get through this. I had one of my funds come to me and tell me, we don't think you're going to survive. And if you do survive, you're going to be so beat up, we can invest at a lower valuation. So, you know, here's what we're willing to
offer. It would just bluntly say that?
Yeah, it was that bluntly. I won't say the fund because, you know, it won't reflect well. But I had other funds come and say, hey, we're going to write a check. Let's go, you know, and let's make this thing happen. We're going to be fine. So, you know, it was a wild experience, a wild ride. And I very much, like we had to take some risks there that made me feel like, oh, this is too much. But it was like, we're going to take the risks. We're going to do what we need to do. And we'll, if necessary, clean things up afterwards. And, you know, in the end, it was one of our best growth periods ever, the pandemic. We grew like crazy.
So you're very pragmatic. And when things become very rough, you ask pragmatic questions, right? Like walk us through how you deal with rough situations. Like, what do you tell yourself? And then how do you take that to action?
I mean, it's good to have really good people around you at every level. Like we have a great board. We have a good management team. A lot of wise people in our orbit. So I think like in rough situations, I definitely like to get people's advice, but in the end, there's so much nuance and detail that like, you know, you could only, it's hard for anyone from the, who's not very intimately involved to understand how to navigate a situation. So, I mean, rough could be anything. It could be a regulatory change. It could be, you know, a need to pivot the business. It could be a need to deal with a plague, a need to deal with like, you know, with war. And who knows if we have pestilence in the future, it could come also. So, you know, there's all sorts of things you have to deal with. No flights. I mean, whatever, what everyone here is dealing with. So my approach has been to communicate very clearly with the team and authentically and accept the fact that it's going to be hard for some people. Try to follow my gut, try to do what's right for customers, what's right for our team members. And just accept that like I can control what I can control and take the right steps.
So then you sort of ask yourself, what can I control, right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly you can't control everything, but the things that we can control. And I'm also aware of playing, like, I always think about what's the, I often ask myself the question, looking back in the long term, what was the right decision? Because a lot of short-term shortcuts.
But in hindsight, you mean in hindsight?
I try to live in hindsight, even sometimes when I'm in the moment. I try to always like look back. You know, we had an example. I'll give you an example. At some point in the company's history, you know, this is like a very mundane thing. We had to cut a department. It just we changed strategy. It didn't make any sense anymore. You know, and we fumbled. We may have fumbled some of the like messaging there, right? Well, then the question is, how do you react to that? Like, do you spend some extra money and even though people aren't going to be happy, but you do the right thing and you make sure people are set up to be successful in their transition out. Or do you just say, you know what, whatever, go figure it out. Meaning, so like, I always try to think in the future, say, looking back, how will I want to look at this moment and say, what was the right thing to do? And that helps me sort of orient, to the right thing. It's not always the convenient thing. And I think I also have come to realize that if you ever look at the company from one perspective, it's a real problem. Is in, if I'm, you know, imagine a, like if you look at the company purely from like a legal sense, we shouldn't sign any contract because there's always inherent risk in contracts, right? If I look at the company just from a sales sense, we should sign every deal, every customer, just bring in the revenue. I think the job of like a CEO or really any like leader who's trying to think about the company is to say, okay, again, there's a lot of players on the field with a lot of missions, but the goal is to win the game. And I always come back to that thing that the, you know, that story about President Kennedy and the United States walking into NASA and seeing the guy cleaning the building and say, hey, what do you do here? He says, you know, Mr. President, I'm trying to put a man on the moon, you know? And I think that that's like a very inspiring way to look at a company. I once heard some guru, I wish I remember his name from, I think he was, you know, like worked at Google or whatever, talk about the philosophy of that, that like in the end, the center is always being pulled apart by the edges. And a lot of the job of leadership is to constantly try to rebuild that center over and over again.
And Aaron, why are you like that? Okay, so I'm hearing someone who is like, you know, like, yeah, you're persistent, you're optimistic. Like, how did you get to be an entrepreneur?
I mean, I think I went through like a lot of the things that, you know, I see are very common in Israeli society around youth groups and the army, and you know, there's a certain element here that enables people who are maybe not good at any one particular thing, but are good at convening and building and movement building to find that path. So,
how did you know that was the path though? Like, you know, it's not like a general option, you know, even if you think you're good at it, like, it doesn't mean that there's a pathway. There's no first degree in entrepreneurship, right?
So, right. Right. I think to a certain extent, maybe it was a benefit of growing up, maybe pre like, you know, the ubiquity of what we have today and what, you know, mobile and what you see on the web and everyone's knows exactly what you're supposed to be like. Like, I know I didn't have an image of what I'm supposed to be like. I just stumbled from one thing to the next in terms of my interests and passions and ideology. And I just came to where I maybe belonged. It wasn't like a lot of people come and interview today. Like, I'll interview an SDR, right? A sales development representative. That's someone who makes phone calls to sell product. And they'll all tell me in 15 years, here's my path. In 15 years, I'm going to be a VP sales. I'm going to start as SDR. I'm going to do that for 3 years. I'm going to then get a job. Blah, blah, blah. They have the whole thing laid out. And I always kind of feel bad for them because I'm like, no. Like, just be open-minded to what comes. What if a cool opportunity comes to, like, I don't know, just go invent something with someone or travel somewhere or build something. Again, like, you don't need to have everything planned out. So I think for me, I maybe didn't see the path forward, but I grew up in a context where I was expected to, if there was a problem in society or, you know, in my community to be active on it. I saw around me people who were leaders, had great examples, and I just went with it. And, you know, moving to Israel on my own and, you know, this country, it's kind of amazing to think about it. Like, an immigrant here could start, I've started like a big nonprofit. And then I started a startup that's, you know, 200 something people and growing like crazy. And, it's pretty amazing that was enabled by the country here. So I don't know, it's a combination of my personality and I think like the context I was in.
So but you said stumbled. So tell me how you stumbled from place to place. Like, how did that stumble?
So, I mean, I basically, I went to, After high school, I went to Israel and went to I went to a Hesder Yeshiva, which is a religious seminary where you also study in join the army. And I drafted into the army. I was in the Nachal in an army infantry unit in Israel. I fully intended to stay in Israel. I thought I would never go back to the United States, even though I love the United States. I thought I would never go back. The army showed one day. I'm in my tent, like after one of those marches and training, and after like 7 or 8 months, I don't know. And I was a lone soldier. So there were these like people who would, you know, take, so to speak, take care of you, whatever, make sure you're okay. You have food, you have a place to do laundry. So she came into the tent. She said, "Hey, we just got told that you could go to America for 4 days to visit your family on the army's bill. As a lone soldier," she's like, "it's going to go, like, this is probably only going to exist for 3 months. If you want to take us up on it, you should go, like, next week." So I'm like, "Yeah, obviously, I'll get on a plane." And I flew to America. And when I was in the States, in Cleveland, visiting my family, my sister was going on a university visit. She was a senior in college or a junior in high school to the University of Michigan. And I love to read. I love books. I love, you know, I love reading history and science fiction, all that. So I'm like, "All right, I'll drive you." So I drove her to Ann Arbor and I got onto campus. I'm like, "Oh my God, this is amazing. All these kids are just laying around all day reading books and like hanging out and going to classes and having intellectual conversations. I'm definitely coming back and doing this." So I completely changed my my plans and ended up going.
Wait, what were the plans still at that point?
Oh, I was planning to stay in Israel and go to, like, you know, stay in the army, keep, I don't have no idea.
Which is exactly like you were thinking when you speak with those SDR.
Yeah. I just thought I would stay in Israel. I didn't even know what I'd
do. I just mean you were applying what you were thinking for the SDR candidate. You're thinking, yes. Hey, I have this plan, but I should be agile because opportunities will arise. And if I'm not there to listen to them, I'm going to miss
them. Yeah, maybe, who knows what, if I'd stayed, I wouldn't have had an American accent in my Hebrew. Maybe that would have been better. But as it is, I went back to college in New York and at Columbia University where I studied, got involved in all sorts of like activist stuff and met some amazing people, met my wife, most importantly, ended up getting married. We both wanted to make Aliyah. Right after college, we basically moved back to Israel. I got a job in a nonprofit, starting journals of like Israel and Jewish thought in the United States. And then I was like, I got called up to reserve duty for the second Lebanon War. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to do something different after this. I'm going to start something. And I started Present Tense, the nonprofit, with my friend. But we started like 5 things at once. And we had no idea what we were going to end up in. And I stumbled into that. And then we built this whole thing up, became a big, you know, big operation. And then at some point I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to do a startup. Called my friend up whose company had just gotten bought. I'm like, "Hey, let's have coffee. We were in the army together. Like, do you want to do something?" And he was like, "Yeah, I also want to do something." He called his buddy from the university. We're like, "All right, let's start something." I mean, that was the stumbling motion. And in the end, today we have a, you know, 250 person company. It's like one of the fastest growing SaaS platforms in Israel. It's, you know, it's a, but it was a big journey to get here.
You know, you had a meaningful life back in the United States. It was impact driven and you lived through values through your family. It was clear that your lens is wide. You're looking at your community as part of your, it's a second nature. And you're also talking about how, you know, when founding this startup, it was important for you that it would be from Jerusalem. So I want to ask you, why was it so important to you to live in Israel? What is it exactly?
Listen, I think Israel is the most amazing place on the planet. And I think it is truly a laboratory for how you can build. It's what our world needs to succeed. Meaning, we need Israel to be successful because I think it can show how you can actually build. I mean, think of like where we are. We're like at this focal point and fault line of the three greatest religions in the world, or three of the four or five greatest religions in the world, the Abrahamic religions. We're in a area that's like really rife with like intolerance, and we have a chance to build like a society that could look, that could include lots of different people, that's entrepreneurial, that creates an ethical and also a vibrant, thriving country. I mean, to me, it's like such an amazing opportunity, and it's small enough that an individual can influence it. I mean, the United States is just, you know, it's 400 million people. It's an incredible place. But I feel like for the future, where you have this like intersection of high tech culture and all the challenges that come along with, you know, the baggage of us being humans and having different identities, Israel's an amazing laboratory. And so it really, really speaks to exactly the things you mentioned for me, which is that bigger vision and how you accomplish things, you know, that are important. I think it's an amazing place to like do things and impact this. It's also just a great place to live. Like, it's a great country.
It's interesting that you're saying it's a great place to live while, you know, and I'm making your life difficult, you know, just to, for the sake of this conversation. But few points, you know, we have terror here. We have rockets flying at us from pretty much every angle. And, you know, life is costly here. And at the end of the day, entrepreneurs that want to succeed here, they end up needing the U.S. market. And we all know so many entrepreneurs who end up relocating to the United States in order to scale their business. So what is it?
First of all, I think I really love the United States, and it's like, you know, it's where I'm from. And I think it's the greatest. It's for sure the greatest country on the planet.
The United States.
By a mile. Yes. But it is a huge, huge country, and it is a complex country. And, you know, and I know it, you know, I have that sort of instinctive knowledge of it because I'm originally from there and stay very close to it. I've traveled there every few weeks for many, many years, even while living in Israel. What I'd say about Israel is that there's a lot of meaning in life here. And I think that the rockets and the, you know, of course, those are horrible. Who wants rockets? But there's just a lot of meaning, the social connections, the way that people treat each other. Again, for better and for worse, like I know I've been here 20 years. I know all the sides of that. But there's just something about the social solidarity that even with all of our problems and all of our disagreements, there's just something energizing and special about this country that it's hard to appreciate. Now, again, if you want a big house with a yard and you want to be able to go to Walmart and just look at absolute like infinite, you know, product and great price, you're not going to get that in Israel. You're going to get friction and you're going to get complexity. But if you want to have maybe kids who are who have independence, who want to, you know, want to achieve things and who are willing to like, you know, my son the other day just like took his bike and like, I don't know, it was like 8 hours driving around the city, you know, peregrinating around. I had no idea where he was, like discovering things. I mean, there's something Israeli about the Israeli culture that is just empowering. And I'm a huge fan of it. So as you can tell, I'm not the person to be critical. Again, I'll talk about politics here. We won't do that here. Be very critical. Talk about, you know, service, customer service here. Our tourism, the way our, you know, the way we handle the war transportation. I can go on and on. But at a fundamental level, it's an amazing place to build. It's an amazing place to live, to raise family, in my opinion.
So, like, I get you. This is something that, by the way, me as well. I'm also here 20 years in Canada. So from choice, it's something that's really hard to explain to someone who's from here.
Yes.
But definitely, like, I like the word meaning because there's a lot more. You feel that if you do something, it's impactful for better or for worse on that side. And I agree that the resilience, self-reliance, and the urgency is three characteristics that really build special people. With that said, I'm going to say this: how much do you feel that wanting to be part of the culture here brought to you the characteristic of persistence in trying to be good at what you do in the startup? Because something feels like that when you're here, you wanted to stay here. And that was like a giant driver of, you know, you have no choice. I'm sleeping in buses. I'm going to succeed. This is going to be amazing because I want to make an impact in Israel. Is there something in that or?
Yeah, I think there is. I think also, listen, like we over time, I mean, look, our company today is, I see our product is involved in, I don't know, a quarter of car sales in the United States. I mean, some insane amount of number. We're supporting these local community businesses that are the car dealerships who employ 250 people who are all really smart. None of them went to Stanford, but they get great salaries and they can on their own merit build their own lives. we're working with businesses that rely on buyers within 30 miles, which means you can't be a bad business. You have to be, if you want to succeed, you have to be really customer service oriented. So I actually am totally engaged with our market and our customers. And that happened over time, meaning on day one, I was not. But so today I actually really, like, I wake up and I'm like, oh, this is fun. Like, we're interacting with all these car dealers. We're helping them sell cars and helping them go places. So it's like a combination of, yes, the culture of Israel, and yes, my personal DNA, and yes, my colleagues, my co-founders, Isha and Eliav. But there's also just something about once you get customers, the customers push you on. And I don't know, you guys probably understand that because you're in the entrepreneurial world. Like, the customers draw you to do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And it's an amazing wind in your sails as an entrepreneur to have customers.
Small businesses, is that like...
Yeah, I don't know what it's like to work with a bank of 500.
You don't know, but I feel, I don't know why, but there's something about also the assistance in your vibe, okay? I feel that that you're actually impactfully helping those small businesses that speaks to you more.
100%. That speaks to me way more. I want to know exactly the impact we're making on a local town. You know, I mean, it's interesting. Like, there's... I don't know if you guys remember those papers that came out probably 10 years ago about the Walmart effect, where, like, you would just plop a Walmart down somewhere and it would kill the downtown. The downtown would go from having, you know, shops and whatever to just becoming basically dead. And I think that, like, we're an anti-Walmart effect company because we're empowering small businesses to keep themselves. And by the way, you could ask the question, why are there car dealerships in the United States? Why aren't all cars sold by Walmart, Amazon, and Costco, right?
Why? Let's ask.
Well, okay, The long and short answer is that it's your second biggest purchase, and it's a complicated purchase, and it takes you want to buy it from someone trusted.
You need a trusted advisor,
and you need to get it serviced. There's a deeper layer, which has to do with the fact that there's also legislation in the United States, and in half the states, that makes it very difficult for a car maker to sell direct. And Tesla is the exception, but they have to do a lot of complicated things to sell direct. And that is actually, interestingly, a product of the Depression era in the United States, because in the Depression, the car makers were experiencing a crash in demand to buy their product, and they forced the car dealers to keep buying cars from them so that they could stay afloat. And the car dealers were like, oh my gosh, like, you're driving us into, they threatened the car dealers, like, we'll put you on the streets. You know, you'll have no family food for your family, right? That was at least the way it's been described to me. And so the car dealers kind of struck back after the Depression by getting all these laws passed preventing car makers from selling directly. And so there's this interesting, like, conflictual relationship that now is, I'd say, actually a pretty nice symbiosis where the car makers benefit from having the car dealers buy their products. And, you know, if you think about it, like, complicated products are typically not sold directly. I mean, Apple is the exception that proves the rule, right? Microsoft stores, Google stores, they don't really work at scale. So right. Apple built out a whole infrastructure, and Apple's a very unique company. Most of these have go-between. So I think the auto industry has been a very stable industry. The number of car dealers has been pretty stable. It's like, 18,000 in the United States, more in Canada, some in Canada. And I think that the businesses are very much, like, built into the community. They understand how to deploy the products. They understand how to work with the consumers, in their local town. It's just, that's the feature. So anyways, I actually like it, though, ideologically, because if you think about it, like, if Amazon or Walmart, I wrote a book about this actually with my co-founders, The Last Dealership, but if you can find it on Amazon, if Amazon or Walmart was selling cars, what would they end up doing, right? They'd end up basically crushing down the margins of the labor and the supply chain, right? That's how they would pass more savings on to the consumer. And I think that that would just be bad, because automotive is still one of the industries that it's like, it's kind of regulated capitalism, but it works for everybody. Like, you get paid a really good salary to work in it. It employs millions and millions and millions of people in the United States by extension, almost probably 10 million if you go beyond. It pays a huge amount of taxes. The long-term questions are, well, if the Chinese are subsidized by the government to make these unbelievable Chinese electric vehicles, how does the American market ultimately compete with the cost basis it has? There's a lot of complex things in there and probably some solutions, but I do think for the most part, it's found the right balance between regulation and societal good. And, you know, obviously capital, you know, the ability to build a business and operate with capitalistic principles. But it will be a there are challenges on the horizon for auto, you know, like exactly that. The Chinese auto market is a fearsome place.
And you've been navigating this for a while now. So while you entered it, you didn't really have an end game in mind beyond the values that obviously trump everything. And that's a great thing. But now you've got a 250 people company. You're strong inside the ecosystem. Where do you want this to be in 5 years?
Yeah, so we're very much like we want to grow and get as big as we can. And we think that the opportunity is really to build an operating system for auto retail. And if you think about it, like as AI moves into the center and agent, you know, the power of agents becomes understood in terms of how it can help with processes. I mean, our tech is going to operate the dealership on behalf of the people that work there. So it will no longer be the case that you like have to go find what to do. Our agents will tell you, hey, here's 14 opportunities that popped up overnight. Here's what you need to do. Can we trigger this? Can we trigger that? Can we launch this email campaign? Like all that work is going to be done by our system. I mean, we're already going down that road nicely. And the people at the dealership are going to be in a lot more of an executive role saying, oh, yes, do this. Don't do that. Yes, trade this vehicle. Don't trade that vehicle. Like, again, you need that sign off from the people whose bank account and jobs are on the line. But a lot of that work is going to be done by our operating system. So if you look at our business in 5 years, we have 25, 30% of the U.S. auto market using our software. And we're running a huge amount of their internal processes around what they call the front of the house, meaning how a car gets sold. In the auto industry, a car dealership has four major profit centers. One is new car. Like this is a franchise dealer, a dealer that has the name of a car maker in it, Toyota, Mercedes, of, you know, Cleveland or whatever, right? So they have a new car business where they sell new cars. They make very little on each sale, but then people bring them back for service and whatnot. They sell used cars where they can make more money because there's, you know, a little bit more margin opportunity there. And then they have what they call fixed ops, which is service, just another way to say service. And they can often fund almost all their expenses from service. And then they have an F&I business, finance and insurance. So all of those businesses are very, very complex. They're very much software involved. There's a lot of vendors, a lot of complexity. Fullpath right now, I mean, my company takes like 20 vendors down into one, you know, on our platform. And I think that's going to be a trend that's going to continue. You know, we'll continuously take more of what happens in the dealership, put it into our platform and enable the dealership to operate.
So like, I have a question, like at the end of the day, so what's the biggest threat there? Like, it sounds like either being purchased or what's the threat? Like, well, what do you?
I don't know. I mean, look, it's funny. Someone once told me, did you guys know this? That in a SWOT, my friend R.L. Beery told me this. In a SWOT analysis, the strengths and weaknesses are internal. The opportunities and threats are external. Did you know that?
Yep.
Is that obvious to everybody but me? Yeah. Well, anyways.
Not obvious, but yes. Okay.
At some point, I discovered that was like, oh, that's cool. I could say that to, you know, when I present SWOTs. But if you think of the SWOTs, like, I mean, obviously, there's internal things that could go wrong. We could mess up. We could stumble. We could pick the wrong product strategy. We could hire bad people. There's a million things we could mess up internally in terms of risks. And then there's the opportunities and threats. I mean, there's a lot of complexity out there in the world. There's a lot of complexity around how retail happens, period. Forget auto retail. There's a lot of complexity around, you know, supply chain. I mean, whoever would have thought that a global pandemic would stop all sales and all car making, period, full stop. What do you do when all your customers? I mean, we weren't like in the travel business, like some of the Israeli companies I'm, you know, friendly with who just lost everything. But for 2 months, we had nothing going on in the United States in our market. Or with the war, like who would have thought like, one day, 30% of my company would just be called up. I mean, it was, you know, those are obviously, there's a lot of things that you have to, but yes, I think Ronan, like in terms of going forward, we're one of the, I mean, I don't ever want to say we're the best because it just sounds cheap, but like, I mean, we really have a technological edge in our market and we're driving very hard to push that edge. And we have a great customer service team. We've built the company in a way where so like 55% Israel, 45% America. Our U.S. team is unbelievable and like works really well with our Israeli team. So we have a really good, really, we have really good momentum and we just have to navigate it. Our company is probably one of the faster growing companies in Israel right now, though we're a little under the radar because of A, we started in Jerusalem, B, we're in an auto vertical. But now, you know, now people are hearing about us. So that's also been fun to get like inbounds of really talented people who want to come work here. So there's a lot of good things going for us.
Which, by the way, like SWAT related, an internal versus external, you knew that you were starting in Jerusalem, you wanted to, and you chose the automotive industry. So no hidden items in that.
No, definitely not. And also, we didn't relocate like that. You mentioned that earlier, Noah. Like, I just felt like as someone who moved from the U.S. to Israel, it was too early for me to relocate back. And, you know, maybe Ronen can identify with that. I'm not sure. But there's something about, you know, you come here, you burn the ships at the shore, and you just stay. And that's the way it goes, you know. And
I love that. And it's a motive with you, because in a sense, yeah, you also burn the ships and you're just on full path.
Yes, basically, that's what's going on.
And that, and I think that that's a great enabler for you, even mentally.
Yes, very much.
Why go on the ship when you have an airplane?
Well, we don't have airplanes either. Hopefully they'll come back. at least the ones that carry lots of people, those don't seem to fly as often as necessary. So, by the way, just like last week to get to, we had this cool deal that was closing and I knew I just till really close it, we had to get out there and get on the ground. So I was like, I got to fly to the U.S. like in 4 days, which in the old days was not a problem. I went to Dubai, hours and hours in Dubai, then traced my way backwards on the map to land. But it was like took forever to get to America on short notice.
Yeah, you have to be creative by default here.
Oh, yeah.
Being in Israel, you just got to get creative.
I'm waiting for the moment when we have a proper complement of flights on the Google flights board.
Me too. So, Aaron, what's your superpower?
Huh. Well, I would say persistence is definitely a superpower of mine. The company probably could have stumbled a few times. And, you know, luckily I have two great co-founders and a great team. But I think, like, I definitely learned persistence over the years. And I think a lot of that came from my father and my mother. But persistence definitely is a superpower, I guess. Never thought about having a superpower, but I guess it would be persistence. I could recommend to like, if I was thinking about what I would tell a person trying to founding a company is one thing, but I would definitely recommend Shabbat as a ironclad principle, because there's just, I always laugh. Like I always say, like I tell people Jerusalem on Shabbat is like the 1990s, like the decade I kind of, you know, most grew up in. There's just something about not having your phone and not feeling like you can access your phone for 24 hours. That's an amazing thing. And I actually feel like that's helped me a lot through the journey, because every week, again, because I treat it like a religious obligation, it just doesn't matter. I can't have my phone. I can't look at work. I can't look at Slack. Can't look at email. Stepping away once a week, and also obviously having that presence with your family, but just being out of the internet is an amazing, amazing superpower if you can access it. And I think it's very difficult to access unless you feel it's almost like a religious obligation, like you can't touch that thing. So if you can find a way in your mind to build up Shabbat as something that's like super important and you go extreme with it, you don't touch your phone, I think you get a huge, don't touch any screen, I think you get a huge boost of energy every single weekend. That's just another thing that's occurred to me recently that I feel builds a superpower.
What an amazing practice of mindfulness.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to do. And then you also go back to just reading paper books and you have like conversations and you just, you know, and I see it with kids too, like on Shabbat, there's no access to a phone. They just become like 90s kids. They just mess around outside. They chase stray cats. They climb signs, you know, climb fences, see what's around. It's a powerful thing. So that's another, if you're asking me for superpowers, I think doing Shabbat creates a superpower.
Love it. And your weakness, your kryptonite?
I get I rabbit holes are my favorite. I love going down rabbit holes. I can get lost in something for, you know, first of all, I have the attention span of 2 weeks max. Like anything going on that is going to be longer than 2 weeks, I always delegate, because I just know I will completely lose focus in 2 weeks, and I can get totally obsessed with like a very obscure detail and spend hours or a day, like a whole day will go by and I've just like tried to figure out one little thing that frankly probably was not the best use of my time. So I think, you know, that obviously everything is two sides. You underuse and overuse strengths and weaknesses. So I think that that has some value in certain cases, but sometimes I get like, I love history. So if I hear about something I don't know about or like an obscure, interesting fact, I can just spend hours just trying to run it down, even though I should be doing something else that's really important.
you go deep.
And one last question. I have a question. If now, let's say the company is, you know, every dream come true, every success you can dream of, you have everything you need. Okay. What would you do?
In the company, I would want to be working on Israeli societal issues and social impact stuff, you know, socioeconomically challenged neighborhoods and people and helping them. And like, I'm very much social impact oriented in terms of what I would choose to spend my time on. I feel very blessed with my company through like if some of our investors, I mean, their names, you probably know, you know, I have like, you know, Ellie Wertman and Michael Eisenberg and Shmulek Chaffetz. Those are Israelis, right?
Yeah.
They're all also very socially oriented. So we do a lot of stuff at our company where like our Jerusalem hub is used by nonprofits all the time. We have our team do volunteering also in the U.S. Around our team. So I love the social impact stuff, but I would like to spend more time on that as I get older, you know, and whatnot. Now the company is an amazing platform to do that. So I do feel blessed on that. In the end of the day, though, you have to make your company work. If your company doesn't work, nothing works. And so like you always have to prioritize that. And I'm very driven in that way. And in the end, look for what matters for the company, because that's what I have to do now. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's why I'm not totally buying into the whole rabbit hole thing, because I think you know when to stop. Sometimes you just let yourself go deep because you follow your curiosity. But I think that enables a lot of growth because you discover stuff in those random journeys.
Potentially, but I spent like a friend of mine who mentioned some that there were like the Bolsheviks, then the Mensheviks. I spent probably like 15 hours reading about the Mensheviks. How did that help Full Path? I have no idea.
I don't know. Steve Jobs would tell you will connect the dots in retrospect.
Maybe.
I don't know what that says about me, but I did the same thing. So,
oh, there you go. Okay. So there you go. We're in good company. Yeah. But anyways, but yeah, I definitely think it's curiosity and, you know, focus can help, but it can sometimes be a little bit overused.
All right. We wish you all the best of luck and to reach a point where you're able to now say, yeah, I can now focus on social impact. But at the same time, it definitely sounds like you're able to generate that impact as you go. And it's not some end game, but a way of life, which is very inspiring. So thank you for everything that you're doing.
Really appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me on and, you know, letting me meet you guys and talk to your audience.
Thanks, Aaron.
Real life.
Superpowers.
Up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
It's alive.
Real life.
Superpowers.